taking me? What has Nassau found? Soon the blue-gray expanse below her became speckled with thousands of stark white dots. Icebergs. Rachel had seen icebergs only once before in her life, 6 years ago when her mother persuaded Rachel to join her on an Alaskan mother-daughter cruise. Rachel had suggested a number of alternative land-based vacations, but her mother was insistent. "Rachel, honey," her mother had said, "two-thirds of this planet is covered with water, and sooner or later you've got to learn to deal with it." Mrs. Sexton was a resilient New Englander, intent on raising a strong daughter. The cruise had been the last trip Rachel and her mother ever took. Catherine Wentworth Sexton. Rachel felt a distant pang of loneliness. Like the howling wind outside the plane, the memories came tearing back, pulling at her the way they always did. Their final conversation had been by phone, Thanksgiving morning. "I'm so sorry, Mom," Rachel said, phoning home from a snowbound O'Hare airport. "I know our family has never spent Thanksgiving Day apart. It looks like today will be our first." Rachel's mom sounded crushed. "I was so looking forward to seeing you." "Me too, Mom. Think of me eating airport food while you and Dad feast on turkey." There was a pause on the line. "Rachel, I wasn't going to tell you until you got here, but your father says he has too much work to make it home this year. He'll be staying at his D.C. suite for the long weekend." "What?" Rachel's surprise gave way immediately to anger. "But it's Thanksgiving. The Senate isn't in session. He's less than 2 hours away. He should be with you." "I know. He says he's exhausted, far too tired to drive. He's decided he needs to spend this weekend curled up with his backlog of work." "Work?" Rachel was skeptical. A more likely guess was that Senator Sexton would be curled up with another woman. His infidelities, though discreet, had been going on for years. Mrs. Sexton was no fool, but her husband's affairs were always accompanied by persuasive alibis and pained indignity at the mere suggestion he could be unfaithful. Finally, Mrs. Sexton saw no alternative but to bury her pain by turning a blind eye. Although Rachel had urged her mother to consider divorce, Catherine Wentworth Sexton was a woman of her word. "Till death do us part," she told Rachel. "Your father blessed me with you, a beautiful daughter, and for that I thank him. He will have to answer for his actions to a higher power someday." Now, standing in the airport, Rachel's anger was simmering. "But this means you'll be alone for Thanksgiving." She felt sick to her stomach. The senator deserting his family on Thanksgiving Day was a new low, even for him. "Well," Mrs. Sexton said, her voice disappointed but decisive, "I obviously can't let all this food go to waste. I'll drive it up to Aunt Anne's. She's always invited us up for Thanksgiving. I'll give her a call right now." Rachel felt only marginally less guilty. "Okay. I'll be home as soon as I can. I love you, Mom. Safe flight, sweetheart." It was 10:30 that night when Rachel's taxi finally pulled up the winding driveway of the Sexton's luxurious estate. Rachel immediately knew something was wrong. Three police cars sat in the driveway. Several news vans, too. All the house lights were on. Rachel dashed in, her heart racing. A Virginia State policeman met her at the doorway. His face was grim. He didn't have to say a word. Rachel knew. There had been an accident. "Route 25 was slick with freezing rain," the officer said. "Your mother went off the road into a wooded ravine. I'm sorry, she died on impact." Rachel's body went numb. Her father, having returned immediately when he got the news, was now in the living room holding a small press conference, stoically announcing to the world that his wife had passed away in a crash on her way back from Thanksgiving dinner with family. Rachel stood in the wings, sobbing through the entire event. "I only wish," her father told the media, his eyes tearful, "that I had been home for her this weekend. This never would have happened." "You should have thought of that years ago," Rachel cried, her loathing for her father deepening with every passing instant. From that moment on, Rachel divorced herself from her father in the way Mrs. Sexton never had. The senator barely seemed to notice. He suddenly had gotten very busy using his late wife's fortunes to begin courting his party's nomination for president. The sympathy vote didn't hurt either. Cruelly now, 3 years later, even at a distance, the senator was making Rachel's life lonely. Her father's run for the White House had put Rachel's dreams of meeting a man and starting a family on indefinite hold. For Rachel, it had become far easier to take herself completely out of the social game than to deal with the endless stream of power-hungry Washingtonian suitors hoping to snag a grieving, potential first daughter while she was still in their league. Outside the F-14, the daylight had started to fade. It was late winter in the Arctic, a time of perpetual darkness. Rachel realized she was flying into a land of permanent night. As the minutes passed, the sun faded entirely, dropping below the horizon. They continued north, and a brilliant three-quarter moon appeared, hanging white in the crystalline glacial air. Far below, the ocean waves shimmered, the icebergs looking like diamonds sewn into a dark sequin mesh. Finally, Rachel spotted the hazy outline of land. But it was not what she had expected. Looming out of the ocean before the plane was an enormous, snow-capped mountain range. "Mountains?" Rachel asked, confused. "There are mountains north of Greenland?" "Apparently," the pilot said, sounding equally surprised. As the nose of the F-14 tipped downward, Rachel felt an eerie weightlessness. Through the ringing in her ears, she could hear a repeated electronic ping in the cockpit. The pilot had apparently locked on to some kind of directional beacon and was following it in. As they passed below 3,000 feet, Rachel stared out at the dramatic moonlit terrain beneath them. At the base of the mountains, an expansive snowy plain swept wide. The plateau spread gracefully seaward about 10 miles until it ended abruptly at a sheer cliff of solid ice that dropped vertically into the ocean. It was then that Rachel saw it, a sight like nothing she had ever seen anywhere on Earth. At first she thought the moonlight must be playing tricks on her. She squinted down at the snowfields, unable to comprehend what she was looking at. The lower the plane descended, the clearer the image became. What in the name of God? The plateau beneath them was striped, as if someone had painted the snow with three huge striations of silver paint. The glistening strips ran parallel to the coastal cliff. Not until the plane dropped past 500 feet did the optical illusion reveal itself. The three silver stripes were troughs, each one over 30 yards wide. The troughs had filled with water and frozen into broad, silvery channels that stretched in parallel across the plateau. The white berms between them were mounded dikes of snow. As they dropped toward the plateau, the plane started bucking and bouncing in heavy turbulence. Rachel heard the landing gear engage with a heavy clunk, but she still saw no landing strip. As the pilot struggled to keep the plane under control, Rachel peered out and spotted two lines of blinking strobes straddling the outermost ice trough. She realized, to her horror, what the pilot was about to do. "We're landing on ice?" she demanded. The pilot didn't respond. He was concentrating on the buffeting wind. Rachel felt a drag in her gut as the craft decelerated and dropped toward the ice channel. High snow berms rose on either side of the aircraft, and Rachel held her breath, knowing the slightest miscalculation in the narrow channel would mean certain death. The wavering plane dropped lower between the berms, and the turbulence suddenly disappeared. Sheltered there from the wind, the plane touched down perfectly on the ice. The Tomcat's rear thrusters roared, slowing the plane. Rachel exhaled. The jet taxied about 100 yards farther and rolled to a stop at a red line spray-painted boldly across the ice. The view to the right was nothing but a wall of snow in the moonlight, the side of an ice berm. The view on the left was identical. Only through the windshield ahead of them did Rachel have any visibility. An endless expanse of ice. She felt like she had landed on a dead planet. Aside from the line on the ice, there were no signs of life. Then Rachel heard it. In the distance, another engine was approaching, higher pitched. The sound grew louder until a machine came into view. It was a large, multi-treaded snow tractor churning toward them up the ice trough. Tall and spindly, it looked like a towering, futuristic insect grinding toward them on voracious, spinning feet. Mounted high on the chassis was an enclosed plexiglass cabin with a rack of floodlights illuminating its way. The machine shuddered to a halt directly beside the F-14. The door on the plexiglass cabin opened, and a figure climbed down a ladder onto the ice. He was bundled from head to foot in a puffy white jumpsuit that gave the impression he had been inflated. Mad Max meets the Pillsbury Doughboy, Rachel thought, relieved at least to see this strange planet was inhabited. The man signaled for the F-14 pilot to pop the hatch. The pilot obeyed. When the cockpit opened, the gust of air that tore through Rachel's body chilled her instantly to the core. "Close the damn lid!" "Miss Sexton," the figure called up to her. His accent was American. "On behalf of NASA, I welcome you." Rachel was shivering. "Thanks a million." "Please unhook your flight harness, leave your helmet in the craft, and deplane by using the fuselage tow holds. Do you have any questions?" "Yes," Rachel shouted back. "Where the hell am I?" Chapter 17. Marjorie Tench, senior advisor to the president, was a loping skeleton of a creature. Her gaunt 6-foot frame resembled an erector set construction of joints and limbs. Overhanging her precarious body was a jaundiced face whose skin resembled a sheet of parchment paper punctured by 2 emotionless eyes. At 51, she looked 70. Tench was revered in Washington as a goddess in the political arena. She was said to possess analytical skills that bordered on the clairvoyant. Her decade running the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research had helped hone a lethally sharp critical mind. Unfortunately, accompanying Tench's political savvy came an icy temperament that few could endure for more than a few minutes. Marjorie Tench had been blessed with all the brains of a supercomputer, and the warmth of one, too. Nonetheless, President Zach Herney had little trouble tolerating the woman's idiosyncrasies. Her intellect and hard work were almost single-handedly responsible for putting Herney in office in the first place. "Marjorie," the president said, standing to welcome her into the Oval Office. "What can I do for you?" He didn't offer her a seat. The typical social graces didn't apply to women like Marjorie Tench. If Tench wanted a seat, she would damn well take one. "I see you set the staff briefing for 4 o'clock this afternoon." Her voice was raspy from cigarettes. "Excellent." Tench paced a moment, and Herney sensed the intricate cogs of her mind turning over and over. He was grateful. Marjorie Tench was one of the select few on the president's staff who was fully aware of the NASA discovery, and her political savvy was helping the president plan his strategy. "This CNN debate today at 1 o'clock, Tench said, coughing. "Who are we sending to spar with Sexton?" Herney smiled. "A junior campaign spokesperson." The political tactic of frustrating the hunter by never sending him any big game was as old as debates themselves. "I have a better idea," Tench said, her barren eyes finding his. "Let me take the spot myself." Zach Herney's head shot up. "You? What the hell is she thinking? Marjorie, you don't do media spots. Besides, it's a midday cable show. If I send my senior advisor, what kind of message does that send? It makes us look like we're panicking." "Exactly." Herney studied her. Whatever convoluted scheme Tench was hatching, there was no way in hell Herney would permit her to appear on CNN. Anyone who had ever laid eyes on Marjorie Tench knew there was a reason she worked behind the scenes. Tench was a frightful-looking woman. Not the kind of face a president wanted delivering the White House message. "I'm taking this CNN debate," she repeated. This time she was not asking. "Marjorie, the president maneuvered, feeling uneasy now. Sexton's campaign will obviously claim your presence on CNN as proof the White House is running scared. Sending out our big guns early makes us look desperate. The woman gave a quiet nod and lit a cigarette. The more desperate we look, the better. For the next 60 seconds, Marjorie Tench outlined why the president would be sending her to the CNN debate instead of some lowly campaign staffer. When Tench was finished, the president could only stare in amazement. Once again, Marjorie Tench had proven herself a political genius. Chapter 18. The Milne Ice Shelf is the largest solid ice floe in the Northern Hemisphere. Located above the 82nd parallel on the northernmost coast of Ellesmere Island in the high Arctic, the Milne Ice Shelf is 4 miles wide and reaches thicknesses of over 300 feet. Now, as Rachel climbed into the plexiglass enclosure atop the ice tractor, she was grateful for the extra parka and gloves waiting for her on her seat, as well as the heat pouring out of the tractor's vents. Outside on the ice runway, the F-14's engines roared and the plane began taxiing away. Rachel looked up in alarm. "He's leaving?" Her new host climbed into the tractor, nodding. "Only science personnel and immediate NASA support team members are allowed on site." As the F-14 tore off into the sunless sky, Rachel felt suddenly marooned. "We'll be taking the ice rover from here," the man said. "The administrator is waiting." Rachel gazed out at the silvery path of ice before them and tried to imagine what the hell the administrator of NASA was doing up here. "Hold on," the NASA man shouted, working some levers. With a grinding growl, the machine rotated 90 degrees in place like a treaded army tank. It was now facing the high wall of a snow berm. Rachel looked at the steep incline and felt a ripple of fear. Surely he doesn't intend to... "Rock and roll!" The driver popped the clutch, and the craft accelerated directly toward the slope. Rachel let out a muffled cry and held on. As they hit the incline, the spiked treads tore into the snow, and the contraption began to climb. Rachel was certain they would tip over backward, but the cabin remained surprisingly horizontal as the treads clawed up the slope. When the huge machine heaved up onto the crest of the berm, the driver brought it to a stop and beamed at his white-knuckled passenger. "Try that in an SUV. We took the shock design system from the Mars Pathfinder and popped it on this baby. Worked like a charm." Rachel gave a wan nod. "Neat." Sitting now atop the snow berm, Rachel looked out at the inconceivable view. One more large berm stood before them, and then the undulation stopped abruptly. Beyond, the ice smoothed into a glistening expanse that was inclined ever so slightly. The moonlit sheet of ice stretched out into the distance, where it eventually narrowed and snaked up into the mountains. "That's the Milne Glacier," the driver said, pointing up into the mountains. "Starts up there and flows down into this wide delta that we're sitting on now." The driver gunned the engine again, and Rachel held on as the craft accelerated down the steep face. At the bottom, they clawed across another ice river and rocketed up the next berm. Mounting the crest and quickly skimming down the far side, they slid out onto a smooth sheet of ice and started crunching across the glacier. "How far?" Rachel saw nothing but ice in front of them. "About 2 miles ahead." Rachel thought it seemed far. The wind outside pounded the ice rover in relentless gusts, rattling the plexiglass as if trying to hurl them back toward the sea. "That's the katabatic wind," the driver yelled. "Get used to it." He explained that this area had a permanent offshore gale called the katabatic, Greek for flowing downhill. The relentless wind was apparently the product of heavy, cold air flowing down the glacial face like a raging river downhill. "This is the only place on Earth," the driver added, laughing, "where hell actually freezes over." Several minutes later, Rachel began to see a hazy shape in the distance in front of them. The silhouette of an enormous white dome emerging from the ice. Rachel rubbed her eyes. What in the world? Big Eskimos up here, eh? The man joked. Rachel tried to make sense of the structure. It looked like a scaled-down Houston Astrodome. NASA put it up a week and a half ago, he said. Multi-stage inflatable plexipolysorbate. Inflate the pieces, affix them to one another, connect the whole thing to the ice with pitons and wires. Looks like an enclosed big-top tent, but it's actually the NASA prototype for the portable habitat we hope to use on Mars someday. We call it the Habosphere. Habosphere. Yeah, get it? Because it's not a whole sphere. It's only Habosphere. Rachel smiled and stared out at the bizarre building now looming closer on the glacial plain. And because NASA hasn't gone to Mars yet, you guys decided to have a big sleepover out here instead. The man laughed. Actually, I would have preferred Tahiti, but fate pretty much decided the location. Rachel gazed uncertainly up at the edifice. The off-white shell was a ghostly contour against a dark sky. As the ice rover neared the structure, it ground to a stop at a small door on the side of the dome, which was now opening. Light from inside spilled out onto the snow. A figure stepped out. He was a bulky giant wearing a black fleece pullover that amplified his size and made him look like a bear. He moved toward the ice rover. Rachel had no doubt who the huge man was, Lawrence Ekstrom, administrator of NASA. The driver gave a solacing grin. Don't let his size fool you. The guy's a pussycat. More like a tiger, Rachel thought, well acquainted with Ekstrom's reputation for biting the heads off those who stood in the way of his dreams. When Rachel climbed down from the ice rover, the wind almost blew her over. She wrapped the coat around herself and moved toward the dome. The NASA administrator met her halfway, extending a huge, gloved paw. Miss Sexton, thank you for coming. Rachel nodded uncertainly and shouted over the howling wind. Frankly, sir, I'm not sure I had much choice. 1,000 meters farther up the glacier, Delta One gazed through infrared binoculars and watched as the administrator of NASA ushered Rachel Sexton into the dome. Chapter 19. NASA Administrator Lawrence Ekstrom was a giant of a man, ruddy and gruff, like an angry Norse god. His prickly blonde hair was cropped military short above a furrowed brow, and his bulbous nose was spidered with veins. At the moment, his stony eyes drooped with the weight of countless sleepless nights. An influential aerospace strategist and operations advisor at the Pentagon before his appointment to NASA, Ekstrom had a reputation for surliness matched only by his incontestable dedication to whatever mission was at hand. As Rachel Sexton followed Lawrence Ekstrom into the Habosphere, she found herself walking through an eerie, translucent maze of hallways. The labyrinth and network appeared to have been fashioned by hanging sheets of opaque plastic across tautly strung wires. The floor of the maze was non-existent, a sheet of solid ice, carpeted with strips of rubber matting for traction. They passed a rudimentary living area lined with cots and chemical toilets. Thankfully, the air in the Habosphere was warm, albeit heavy with the mingled potpourri of smells that accompany humans in tight quarters. Somewhere a generator droned, apparently the source of the electricity that powered the bare bulbs hanging from draped extension cords in the hallway. "Miss Sexton," Ekstrom grunted, guiding her briskly toward some unknown destination. "Let me be candid with you right from the start." His tone conveyed anything but pleasure to have Rachel as his guest. "You are here because the President wants you here. Zach Herney is a personal friend of mine, and a faithful NASA supporter. I respect him, I owe him, and I trust him. I do not question his direct orders, even when I resent them. Just so there's no confusion, be aware that I do not share the President's enthusiasm for involving you in this matter." Rachel could only stare. I traveled 3,000 miles for this kind of hospitality? This guy was no Martha Stewart. "With all due respect," she fired back. I am also under presidential orders. I have not been told my purpose here. I made this trip on good faith. Fine, Ekstrom said. Then I will speak bluntly. You made a damn good start. Rachel's tough response seemed to jolt the administrator. His stride slowed a moment, his eyes clearing as he studied her. Then, like a snake uncoiling, he heaved a long sigh and picked up the pace. Understand, Ekstrom began, that you are here on a classified NASA project against my better judgment. Not only are you a representative of the NRO, whose director enjoys dishonoring NASA personnel as loose-lipped children, but you are the daughter of the man who has made it his personal mission to destroy my agency. This should be NASA's hour in the sun. My men and women have endured a lot of criticism lately and deserve this moment of glory. However, due to a torrent of skepticism spearheaded by your father, NASA finds itself in a political situation where my hardworking personnel are forced to share the spotlight with a handful of random civilian scientists and the daughter of a man who was trying to destroy us. I am not my father, Rachel wanted to shout. But this was hardly the moment to debate politics with the head of NASA. I did not come here for the spotlight, sir. Ekstrom glared. You may find you have no alternative. The comment took her by surprise. Although President Herney had said nothing specific about her assisting him in any sort of public way, William Pickering had certainly aired his suspicions that Rachel might become a political pawn. I'd like to know what I'm doing here, Rachel demanded. You and me both. I do not have that information. I'm sorry? The president asked me to brief you fully on our discovery the moment you arrived. Whatever role he wants you to play in this circus is between you and him. He told me your Earth observation system had made a discovery. Ekstrom glanced sidelong at her. How familiar are you with the EOS project? EOS is a constellation of 5 NASA satellites which scrutinize the Earth in different ways. Ocean mapping, geologic fault analyses, polar ice melt observation, location of fossil fuel reserves. Fine, Ekstrom said, sounding unimpressed. So you're aware of the newest addition to the EOS constellation? It's called PODS. Rachel nodded. The Polar Orbiting Density Scanner, PODS, was designed to help measure the effects of global warming. As I understand it, PODS measures the thickness and hardness of the polar ice cap. In effect, yes. It uses spectral band technology to take composite density scans of large regions and find softness anomalies in the ice. Slush spots, internal melting, large fissures, indicators of global warming. Rachel was familiar with composite density scanning. It was like a subterranean ultrasound. NRO satellites had used similar technology to search for subsurface density variants in Eastern Europe and locate mass burial sites, which confirmed for the president that ethnic cleansing was indeed going on. 2 weeks ago, Ekstrom said, PODS passed over this ice shelf and spotted a density anomaly that looked nothing like anything we'd expected to see. 200 feet beneath the surface, perfectly embedded in a matrix of solid ice, PODS saw what looked like an amorphous globule about 10 feet in diameter. A water pocket? Rachel asked. No, not liquid. Strangely, this anomaly was harder than the ice surrounding it. Rachel paused. So, it's a boulder or something? Ekstrom nodded. Essentially. Rachel waited for the punchline. It never came. I'm here because NASA found a big rock in the ice? Not until PODS calculated the density of this rock did we get excited. We immediately flew a team up here to analyze it. As it turns out, the rock in the ice beneath us is significantly more dense than any type of rock found here on Ellesmere Island. More dense, in fact, than any type of rock found within a 400-mile radius. Rachel gazed down at the ice beneath her feet, picturing the huge rock down there somewhere. You're saying someone moved it here? Ekstrom looked vaguely amused.
The stone weighs more than 8 tons. It is embedded under 200 feet of solid ice, meaning it has been there untouched for over 300 years.
Rachel felt tired as she followed the administrator into the mouth of a long, narrow corridor passing between 2 armed NASA workers who stood guard. Rachel glanced at Ekstrom. I assume there's a logical explanation for the stone's presence here, and for all this secrecy.
There most certainly is, Ekstrom said, deadpan. The rock Pods found is a meteorite.
Rachel stopped dead in the passageway and stared at the administrator. A meteorite? A surge of disappointment washed over her. A meteorite seemed utterly anticlimactic after the president's big buildup. This discovery will single-handedly justify all of NASA's past expenditures and blunders? What was Herney thinking? Meteorites were admittedly one of the rarest rocks on the Earth, but NASA discovered meteorites all the time.
This meteorite is one of the largest ever found, Ekstrom said, standing rigid before her. We believe it is a fragment of a larger meteorite, documented to have hit the Arctic Ocean in the 1700s. Most likely this rock was thrown as ejecta from that ocean impact, landed on the Milne Glacier, and was slowly buried by snow over the past 300 years.
Rachel scowled. This discovery changed nothing. She felt a growing suspicion that she was witnessing an overblown publicity stunt by a desperate NASA and White House. Two struggling entities attempting to elevate a propitious find to the level of earth-shattering NASA victory.
You don't look too impressed, Ekstrom said.
I guess I was just expecting something else. Ekstrom's eyes narrowed.
A meteorite of this size is a very rare find, Miss Sexton. There are only a few larger in the world.
I realize.
But the size of the meteorite is not what excites us.
Rachel glanced up.
If you would permit me to finish, Ekstrom said, you will learn that this meteorite displays some rather astonishing characteristics never before seen in any meteorite, large or small.
He motioned down the passageway.
Now, if you'd follow me, I'll introduce you to someone more qualified than I to discuss this find.
Rachel was confused.
Someone more qualified than the administrator of NASA?
Ekstrom's Nordic eyes locked in on hers.
More qualified, Miss Sexton, insofar as he is a civilian. I had assumed because you are a professional data analyst that you would prefer to get your data from an unbiased source.
Touché. Rachel backed off.
She followed the administrator down the narrow corridor, where they dead-ended at a heavy black drapery. Beyond the drape, Rachel could hear the reverberant murmur of a crowd of voices rumbling on the other side, echoing as if in a giant open space. Without a word, the administrator reached up and pulled aside the curtain. Rachel was blinded by a dazzling brightness. Hesitant, she stepped forward, squinting into the glistening space. As her eyes adjusted, she gazed out at the massive room before her and drew an awestruck breath.
My God, she whispered. What is this place? Chapter 20.
The CNN production facility outside of Washington, D.C. is one of 212 studios worldwide that link via satellite to the global headquarters of Turner Broadcasting System in Atlanta. It was 1:45 p.m. when Senator Sedgwick Sexton's limousine pulled into the parking lot. Sexton was feeling smug as he got out and strode toward the entrance. He and Gabrielle were greeted inside by a pot-bellied CNN producer who wore an effusive smile.
Senator Sexton, the producer said, welcome. Great news. We just found out who the White House sent as a sparring partner for you.
The producer gave a foreboding grin.
I hope you brought your game face.
He motioned through the production glass out into the studio. Sexton looked through the glass and almost fell over. Staring back at him through the smoky haze of her cigarette was the ugliest face in politics.
"Marjorie Tench," Gabrielle blurted. "What the hell is she doing here?"
Sexton had no idea, but whatever the reason, her presence here was fantastic news. A clear sign that the president was in desperation mode. Why else would he send his senior advisor to the front lines? President Zach Herney was rolling out the big guns, and Sexton welcomed the opportunity. The bigger the foe, the harder they fall. The senator had no doubt that Tench would be a sly opponent, but gazing now at the woman, Sexton could not help but think that the president had made a serious error in judgment. Marjorie Tench was hideous-looking. At the moment, she sat slouched in her chair, smoking a cigarette, her right arm moving in languid rhythm back and forth to her thin lips like a giant praying mantis feeding. Jesus, Sexton thought, if there was ever a face that should stick to radio. The few times Sedgwick Sexton had seen the White House senior advisor's jaundiced mug in a magazine, he couldn't believe he was looking at one of the most powerful faces in Washington.
"I don't like this," Gabrielle whispered.
Sexton barely heard her. The more he considered the opportunity, the more he liked it. Even more fortuitous than Tench's media-unfriendly face was Tench's reputation on one key issue. Marjorie Tench was extremely vocal that America's leadership role in the future could only be secured through technological superiority. She was an avid supporter of high-tech government R&D programs and, most important, NASA. Many believed it was Tench's behind-the-scenes pressure that kept the president positioned so staunchly behind the failing space agency. Sexton wondered if perhaps the president was now punishing Tench for all the bad advice about supporting NASA. Is he throwing his senior advisor to the wolves? Gabrielle Ash gazed through the glass at Marjorie Tench and felt a growing uneasiness. This woman was smart as hell, and she was an unexpected twist. Those two facts had her instincts tingling. Considering the woman's stance on NASA, the president sending her to face off against Senator Sexton seemed ill-advised, but the president was certainly no fool. Something told Gabrielle this interview was bad news. Gabrielle already sensed the senator salivating over his odds, which did little to curb her concern. Sexton had a habit of going overboard when he got cocky. The NASA issue had been a welcome boost in the polls, but Sexton had been pushing very hard lately, she thought. Plenty of campaigns had been lost by candidates who went for the knockout when all they needed was to finish the round. The producer looked eager for the impending blood match.
"Let's get you set up, Senator."
As Sexton headed for the studio, Gabrielle caught his sleeve.
"I know what you're thinking," she whispered, "but just be smart. Don't go overboard."
"Overboard? Me?" Sexton grinned.
"Remember, this woman is very good at what she does."
Sexton gave her a suggestive smirk.
"So am I."
Chapter 21. The cavernous main chamber of NASA's habosphere would have been a strange sight anywhere on Earth, but the fact that it existed on an Arctic ice shelf made it that much more difficult for Rachel Sexton to assimilate. Staring upward into a futuristic dome crafted of white interlocking triangular pads, Rachel felt like she had entered a colossal sanatorium. The walls sloped downward to a floor of solid ice, where an army of halogen lamps stood like sentinels around the perimeter, casting stark light skyward and giving the whole chamber an ephemeral luminosity. Snaking across the ice floor, black foam carpet runners wound like boardwalks through a maze of portable scientific workstations. Amid the electronics, 30 or 40 white-clad NASA personnel were hard at work, conferring happily and talking in excited tones. Rachel immediately recognized the electricity in the room. It was the thrill of new discovery. As Rachel and the administrator circled the outer edge of the dome, she noted the surprised looks of displeasure from those who recognized her. Their whispers carried clearly in the reverberant space. Isn't that Senator Sexton's daughter? What the hell is she doing here? I can't believe the administrator is even speaking to her. Rachel half expected to see voodoo dolls of her father dangling everywhere. The animosity around her, though, was not the only emotion in the air. Rachel also sensed a distinct smugness, as if NASA clearly knew who would be having the last laugh. The administrator led Rachel toward a series of tables where a lone man sat at a computer workstation. He was dressed in a black turtleneck, wide whale corduroys, and heavy boat shoes, rather than the matching NASA weather gear everyone else seemed to be wearing. He had his back to them. The administrator asked Rachel to wait as he went over and spoke to the stranger. After a moment, the man in the turtleneck gave him a congenial nod and started shutting down his computer. The administrator returned.
"Mr. Tolland will take it from here," he said. "He's another one of the president's recruits, so you two should get along fine. I'll join you later."
"Thank you."
"I assume you've heard of Michael Tolland."
Rachel shrugged, her brain still taking in the incredible surroundings. "Name doesn't ring a bell."
The man in the turtleneck arrived, grinning.
"Doesn't ring a bell?"
His voice was resonant and friendly.
"Best news I've heard all day. Seems I never get a chance to make a first impression anymore."
When Rachel glanced up at the newcomer, her feet froze in place. She knew the man's handsome face in an instant. Everyone in America did.
"Oh," she said, blushing as the man shook her hand. "You're that Michael Tolland."
When the president had told Rachel he had recruited top-notch civilian scientists to authenticate NASA's discovery, Rachel had imagined a group of wizened nerds with monogrammed calculators. Michael Tolland was the antithesis. One of the best-known science celebrities in America today, Tolland hosted a weekly documentary called Amazing Seas, during which he brought viewers face-to-face with spellbinding oceanic phenomena. Underwater volcanoes, 10-foot sea worms, killer tidal waves. The media hailed Tolland as a cross between Jacques Cousteau and Carl Sagan, crediting his knowledge, unpretentious enthusiasm, and lust for adventure as the formula that had rocketed Amazing Seas to the top of the ratings. Of course, most critics admitted, Tolland's rugged good looks and self-effacing charisma probably didn't hurt his popularity with the female audience.
"Mr. Tolland," Rachel said, fumbling the words a bit. "I'm Rachel Sexton."
Tolland smiled a pleasant, crooked smile.
"Hi, Rachel. Call me Mike."
Rachel found herself uncharacteristically tongue-tied. Sensory overload was setting in. The habosphere, the meteorite, the secrets, finding herself unexpectedly face-to-face with a television star.
"I'm surprised to see you here," she said, attempting to recover.
"When the president told me he'd recruited civilian scientists for authentication of a NASA find, I guess I expected..." She hesitated.
"Real scientists?"
Tolland grinned.
Rachel flushed, mortified.
"That's not what I meant."
"Don't worry about it," Tolland said. "That's all I've heard since I got here."
The administrator excused himself, promising to catch up with him later. Tolland turned now to Rachel with a curious look.
"The administrator tells me your father is Senator Sexton?"
Rachel nodded. Unfortunately, she thought.
"A Sexton spy behind enemy lines?"
"Battle lines are not always drawn where you might think."
An awkward silence.
"So tell me," Rachel said quickly, "what's a world-famous oceanographer doing on a glacier with a bunch of NASA rocket scientists?"
Tolland chuckled.
"Actually, some guy who looked a lot like the president asked me to do him a favor. I opened my mouth to say, 'Go to hell,' but somehow I blurted, 'Yes, sir.'"
Rachel laughed for the first time all morning.
"Join the club."
Although most celebrities seemed smaller in person, Rachel thought Michael Tolland appeared taller. His brown eyes were just as vigilant and passionate as they were on television, and his voice carried the same modest warmth and enthusiasm. Looking to be a weathered and athletic 45, Michael Tolland had coarse black hair that fell in a permanent windswept tuft across his forehead. He had a strong chin and a carefree mannerism that exuded confidence. When he'd shaken Rachel's hand, the calloused roughness of his palms reminded her he was not a typical soft television personality, but rather an accomplished seaman and hands-on researcher. "To be honest," Tolland admitted, sounding sheepish, "I think I was recruited more for my PR value than for my scientific knowledge. The president asked me to come up and make a documentary for him." "A documentary? About a meteorite? But you're an oceanographer." "That's exactly what I told him. But he said he didn't know of any meteorite documentarians. He told me my involvement would help bring mainstream credibility to this find. Apparently, he plans to broadcast my documentary as part of tonight's big press conference when he announces the discovery." A celebrity spokesman. Rachel sensed the savvy political maneuverings of Zach Herney at work. NASA was often accused of talking over the public's head. Not this time. They'd pulled in the master scientific communicator, a face Americans already knew and trusted when it came to science. Tolland pointed kitty-corner across the dome to a far wall where a press area was being set up. There was a blue carpet on the ice, television cameras, media lights, a long table with several microphones. Someone was hanging a backdrop of a huge American flag. "That's for tonight," he explained. "The NASA administrator and some of his scientists will be connected live via satellite to the White House so they can participate in the president's 8 o'clock broadcast." Appropriate, Rachel thought, pleased to know Zach Herney didn't plan to cut NASA out of the announcement entirely. "So," Rachel said with a sigh, "is someone finally going to tell me what's so special about this meteorite?" Tolland arched his eyebrows and gave her a mysterious grin. "Actually, what's so special about this meteorite is best seen, not explained." He motioned for Rachel to follow him toward the neighboring work area. "The guy stationed over here has plenty of samples he can show you." "Samples? You actually have samples of the meteorite?" "Absolutely. We've drilled quite a few. In fact, it was the initial core samples that alerted NASA to the importance of the find." Unsure of what to expect, Rachel followed Tolland into the work area. It appeared deserted. A cup of coffee sat on a desk scattered with rock samples, calipers, and other diagnostic gear. The coffee was steaming. "Marlinson!" Tolland yelled, looking around. No answer. He gave a frustrated sigh and turned to Rachel. "He probably got lost trying to find cream for his coffee. I'm telling you, I went to Princeton Post grad with this guy, and he used to get lost in his own dorm. Now he's a National Medal of Science recipient in astrophysics. Go figure." Rachel did a double take. "Marlinson? You don't by any chance mean the famous Corky Marlinson, do you?" Tolland laughed. "One and the same." Rachel was stunned. "Corky Marlinson is here?" Marlinson's ideas on gravitational fields were legendary among NRO's satellite engineers. "Marlinson is one of the president's civilian recruits?" "Yeah, one of the real scientists." "Real is right," Rachel thought. Corky Marlinson was as brilliant and respected as they came. "The incredible paradox about Corky," Tolland said, "is that he can quote you the distance to Alpha Centauri in millimeters, but he can't tie his own necktie."
"I wear clip-ons."
A nasal, good-natured voice barked nearby.
"Efficiency over style, Mike. You Hollywood types don't understand that."
Rachel and Tolland turned to the man now emerging from behind a large stack of electronic gear. He was squat and rotund, resembling a pug dog with bubble eyes and a thinning, comb-over haircut. When the man saw Tolland standing with Rachel, he stopped in his tracks.
"Jesus Christ, Mike, we're at the friggin' North Pole, and you still managed to meet gorgeous women. I knew I should have gone into television."
Michael Tolland was visibly embarrassed.
"Miss Sexton, please excuse Dr. Marlinson. What he lacks in tact, he more than makes up for in random bits of totally useless knowledge about our universe."
Corky approached.
"A true pleasure, man. I didn't catch your name."
"Rachel," she said. "Rachel Sexton."
"Sexton?"
Corky let out a playful gasp.
No relation to that short-sighted, depraved senator, I hope.
Tolland winced. Actually, Corky, Senator Sexton is Rachel's father. Corky stopped laughing and slumped.
You know, Mike, it's really no wonder I've never had any luck with the ladies.
Chapter 22. Prize-winning astrophysicist Corky Marlinson ushered Rachel and Tolland into his work area and began sifting through his tools and rock samples. The man moved like a tightly wound spring about to explode.
All right, he said, quivering excitedly. Miss Sexton, you're about to get the Corky Marlinson 30-second meteorite primer.
Tolland gave Rachel a be patient wink. Bear with him. The man really wanted to be an actor.
Yeah, and Mike wanted to be a respected scientist.
Corky rooted around in a shoebox and produced three small rock samples and aligned them on his desk.
These are the three main classes of meteorites in the world.
Rachel looked at the three samples. All appeared as awkward spheroids about the size of golf balls. Each had been sliced in half to reveal its cross-section.
All meteorites, Corky said, consist of varying amounts of nickel-iron alloys, silicates, and sulfides. We classify them on the basis of their metal-to-silicate ratios.
Rachel already had the feeling Corky Marlinson's meteorite primer was going to be more than 30 seconds.
This first sample here, Corky said, pointing to a shiny jet-black stone, is an iron-core meteorite. Very heavy. This little guy landed in Antarctica a few years back.
Rachel studied the meteorite. It most certainly looked otherworldly, a blob of heavy grayish iron whose outer crust was burned and blackened.
That charred outer layer is called a fusion crust, Corky said. It's the result of extreme heating as the meteor falls through our atmosphere. All meteorites exhibit that charring.
Corky moved quickly to the next sample.
This next one is what we call a stony iron meteorite.
Rachel studied the sample, noting that it, too, was charred on the outside. This sample, however, had a light greenish tint, and the cross-section looked like a collage of colorful angular fragments, resembling a kaleidoscopic puzzle.
Pretty, Rachel said. Are you kidding? It's gorgeous.
Corky talked for a minute about the high olivine content, causing the green luster. And then he reached dramatically for the third and final sample, handing it to Rachel. Rachel held the final meteorite in her palm. This one was grayish-brown in color, resembling granite. It felt heavier than a terrestrial stone, but not substantially. The only indication suggesting it was anything other than a normal rock was its fusion crust, the scorched outer surface.
This, Corky said with finality, is called the stony meteorite. It's the most common class of meteorite. More than 90% of meteorites found on Earth are of this category.
Rachel was surprised. She had always pictured meteorites more like the first sample, metallic, alien-looking blobs. The meteorite in her hand looked anything but extraterrestrial. Aside from the charred exterior, it looked like something she might step over on the beach. Corky's eyes were bulging now with excitement.
The meteorite buried in the ice here at Milne is a stony meteorite, a lot like the one in your hand. Stony meteorites appear almost identical to our terrestrial igneous rocks, which makes them tough to spot. Usually a blend of lightweight silicates, feldspar, olivine, pyroxene, nothing too exciting.
I'll say, Rachel thought, handing the sample back to him. This one looks like a rock someone left in a fireplace and burned. Corky burst out laughing.
One hell of a fireplace. The meanest blast furnace ever built doesn't come close to reproducing the heat a meteoroid feels when it hits our atmosphere. They get ravaged.
Tolland gave Rachel an empathetic smile. This is the good part.
Picture this,
Corky said, taking the meteorite sample from Rachel.
Let's imagine this little fella is the size of a house.
He held the sample high over his head.
Okay, it's in space, floating across our solar system, cold-soaked from the temperature of space to minus 100 degrees Celsius.
Tallon was chuckling to himself, apparently already having seen Corky's reenactment of the meteorite's arrival on Ellesmere Island. Corky began lowering the sample.
Our meteorite is moving toward Earth, and as it's getting very close, our gravity locks on, accelerating, accelerating.
Rachel watched as Corky sped up the sample's trajectory, mimicking the acceleration of gravity.
Now it's moving fast, Corky exclaimed. Over 10 miles per second, 36,000 miles per hour. At 135 kilometers from the Earth's surface, the meteorite begins to encounter friction with the atmosphere.
Corky shook the sample violently as he lowered it toward the ice.
Falling below 100 kilometers, it's starting to glow. Now the atmospheric density is increasing, and the friction is incredible. The air around the meteoroid is becoming incandescent as the surface material melts from the heat.
Corky started making burning and sizzling sound effects.
Now it's falling past the 80-kilometer mark, and the exterior becomes heated to over 1,800 degrees Celsius.
Rachel watched in disbelief as the presidential, award-winning astrophysicist shook the meteorite more fiercely, sputtering out juvenile sound effects.
60 kilometers!
Corky was shouting now.
Our meteoroid encounters the atmospheric wall. The air is too dense. It violently decelerates at more than 300 times the force of gravity.
Corky made a screeching, braking sound and slowed his descent dramatically.
Instantly, the meteorite cools and stops glowing. We've hit dark flight. The meteoroid's surface hardens from its molten stage to a charred fusion crust.
Rachel heard Tallon groan as Corky knelt down on the ice to perform the coup de grace. Earth impact.
Now, Corky said, our huge meteorite is skipping across our lower atmosphere.
On his knees, he arched the meteorite toward the ground on a shallow slant.
It's headed toward the Arctic Ocean, on an oblique angle, falling, looking almost like it will skip off the ocean, falling, and...
He touched the sample to the ice.
Bam!
Rachel jumped.
The impact is cataclysmic. The meteorite explodes. Fragments fly off, skipping and spinning across the ocean.
Corky went into slow motion now, rolling and tumbling the sample across the invisible ocean toward Rachel's feet.
One piece keeps skimming, tumbling toward Ellesmere Island.
He brought it right up to her toe.
It skips off the ocean, bouncing up onto land.
He moved it up and over the tongue of her shoe and rolled it to a stop on top of her foot near her ankle.
And finally comes to rest high on the Milne Glacier, where snow and ice quickly cover it, protecting it from atmospheric erosion.
Corky stood up with a smile. Rachel's mouth fell slack. She gave an impressed laugh.
Well, Dr. Marlinson, that explanation was exceptionally...
lucid?
Corky offered. Rachel smiled.
In a word.
Corky handed the sample back to her.
Look at the cross-section.
Rachel studied the rock's interior a moment, seeing nothing.
Tilt it into the light,
Tallon prompted, his voice warm and kind.
And look closely.
Rachel brought the rock close to her eyes and tilted it against the dazzling halogens reflecting overhead. Now she saw it. Tiny metallic globules glistening in the stone. Dozens of them were peppered throughout the cross-section like minuscule droplets of mercury, each only about a millimeter across.
Those little bubbles are called chondrils, Corky said, and they occur only in meteorites.
Rachel squinted at the droplets. Granted, I've never seen anything like this in an earth rock.
Nor will you,
Corky declared.
Chondrils are one geologic structure we simply do not have on Earth. Some chondrils are exceptionally old, perhaps made of the earliest materials on the universe. Other chondrils are much younger, like the ones in your hand. The chondrils in that meteorite date only about 190 million years old.
190 million years is young?
Heck yes. In cosmological terms, that's yesterday. The point here, though, is that this sample contains chondrils, conclusive meteoric evidence. Okay, Rachel said. Chondrules are conclusive. Got it. And finally,
Corky said, heaving a sigh, if the fusion crest and